Hello, I am Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
The three amigos back together.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're sitting in the courtyard outside the British Library, near to St Pancras Railway Station in England's capital, Britain's capital, London.
Near where today's stage of the Vuelta a España finishes. Daniel is en route to Spain for the Vuelta, so we'll have some wonderful material. Maybe he'll do another sort of Arctic special report style.
Subject to, well, lack of popular demand.
I think the Arctic report went down a storm, Daniel, appropriately enough.
Really? An Arctic storm?
A snowstorm. Okay. Right, so today we're going to talk about the Vuelta, which has taken a bit of a twist in the last 24 hours, and we're going to look ahead to the Tour of Britain. Lionel and I will both be on the Tour of Britain, and we will be bringing you two, maybe three podcasts over the course of the week. Anyway, Vuelta.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, La de Vuelta a España, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Lionel, you've been watching much of the Vuelta. We're speaking after the time trial stage, the sort of decisive, potentially, time trial stage, which saw Alberto Contador take the leader's jersey. As somebody pointed out on Twitter today, he has never lost a leader's jersey in a Grand Tour. Having assumed the leadership, he's never lost it. Other than 2010 at the Tour de France, where he did actually lose the leader's jersey, but that was because he tested positive, and it came some months after the event.
I might lose us a few listeners by pointing out this makes him the Tiger Woods of professional cycling, because Tiger Woods, of course, has never relinquished the lead, I think, on the final day of a major championship.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So Contador is in the lead. Quintana, who we fancied challenging him, had a terrible crash on a descent on a sort of tight, technical, twisty course, 36 something kilometre time trial won by Tony Martin. It was a terrible crash. He seemed to be adjusting his shoe just before quite a nasty sort of sweeping right-hand corner. And hit the barriers and somersaulted, and he was maybe quite lucky not to be more badly hurt. But Lionel, have you been watching much of the Vuelta?
Yeah, I have. I've watched most of the stages so far, I think all bar one. But the time trial yesterday really turned the race on its head, didn't it? It looked like Quintana was going to be the man to beat, and it looked like Contador was going to sort of defy the odds. The big story really is the severity of Contador's injury from the Tour de France. We all remember his bad crash in the Vosges Mountains, where he hit his leg and his knee very hard, pulled out of the race that day, issued a statement within hours saying that, you know, the Vuelta would be very unlikely, then confirmed he wouldn't start the Vuelta. Then there were rumours of reported sightings of Contador training very hard in the Lugano region, and obviously he's come into the Vuelta. And his performance so far has to kind of shed a bit of doubt on how accurately he was portraying the extent of those injuries, because he's riding incredibly well. Considering he was, you would have thought he came off from his crash much worse than Chris Froome did from his, and the fact that Froome had, what, another sort of 4 or 5 days to recover from his injuries and probably resumed full training earlier, it's quite a remarkable turnaround for Contador, isn't it?
We should mention Froome. I mean, he had a bad day in the time trial. You would expect him to beat Contador in a time trial like that, I think, or it'd be close. So there was a hilly time trial in last year's Tour, of course, where it was pretty close, but Froome won it. Sorry, Daniel's pointing out somebody striding across the courtyard here in the library.
And
Harry Ostea. Real sort of pre-Raphaelite.
Classic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just should explain, yeah, that's the jersey of the Ariosteia team from the early 90s. Giancarlo Ferretti, one of the Italian super teams that kind of emerged at the start of the 90s. I'm not quite sure what that coincided with, but did they make ceramic roof tiles, and that's why it looks like yellow and red roof tiles on the jersey? You don't see much of that these days. I mean, I always think that Sky's jersey really should have had a giant satellite dish on the back, but you know, you portray what your sponsor does on the jersey.
Not an actual satellite dish, a picture of a satellite dish. No, nice shorts, Ariostea, they had. I had a pair of Ariostea shorts. I like them, big yellow panels. Anyway, I was saying Froome had a bad day at the office, finished 11th in time trial, lost a minute and a half to Tony Martin, the winner. Conceded quite a serious amount of time to Contador as well. And Contador has to be the hot favourite now, does he, Daniel?
Yeah, I would think so, although it's still pretty tight. You know, for all that yesterday seemed to open up some big gaps, there were still about five riders within, let me just see, within, well, there's six riders within 1 minute 37. Joaquin Rodriguez is 1:37. So there are a lot of guys still in there with a shout. I mean, it's 51 days yesterday's time trial since Contador's injury at the, or his crash at the Tour. So as you say, it's a very quick recovery. There's sort of echoes here of when Astana were denied their place in the 2008 Tour and Contador was kind of plucked from a Spanish beach, supposedly, and thrown into the Giro d'Italia. I remember Ricardo Rico being very disparaging of this idea that he'd come straight off the beach and he christened him the Bagnino, in Italian, which is the lifeguard. So, yeah, there is some history there with Contador. But, you know, it is a shame that Quintana crashed yesterday, and we just have to see now in the next few days how badly he's affected, because he's only just over 3 minutes down. He's not out of the running, but from Movistar's point of view, it's a pity, because I still don't think Valverde is a really credible challenger to Contador. When the big mountains come, you know, we've still got Covadonga, we've still got Ancares, we've still got some really tough stuff to come.
I mean, some po-faced sort of reaction to Contador if he was bluffing about the severity of his injury. It's not just part of the game. I mean, if his injury wasn't as bad as was initially feared, and he made a quicker recovery, and he did start to believe that he could come to the Vuelta and challenge, is he compelled to tell the absolute truth about his injury? We see this in other sports all the time. People bluff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the eve of a big football match, sorry to use another footballing example, but if your star striker is suffering with an injury, the manager's not going to let the cat out of the bag and give the opposition the encouragement they need to think that they may well be facing a player who's not at his best.
That's a reverse situation, though, isn't it? That's the opposite. That's pretending you don't have an injury when you do, rather than pretending you don't have an injury when you might. Is it the opposite?
The assumption is that Contador has you know, he's better than perhaps he led people to believe, but you know, bluffing is all part of the game. If you can, I think, you know, because cycling has had this history of sort of such dishonesty in terms of doping, that it all gets, this whole moral question gets all wrapped up together, and I think it's completely different. If you're not feeling as good as your opponents might think you are, then you've got to maintain the mask, maintain the game face, and the same works the other way around. And Contador, if he's better, it works to his advantage if everybody else thinks that he's riding on one leg.
And we've seen it in microcosm in stages, haven't we, where riders have pretended to be tired, lull their opponents into thinking that they're not as strong as they are. We saw it with Lance Armstrong, remember him? Mm. Bjarne Riis, two great examples. But I'm sure there are other examples as well, going back through history of riders bluffing and sort of lulling their rivals into thinking that there's a good time to attack them. And
well, as you know, Richard, you know, Bernardino said, you know, attack when you're feeling weak, because it puts your opponents on the back foot. And I can't remember who it was. Was it Luis Ombobe who said you finish your opponent's dinner before you start on your own?
Pretty good. I mean, what's surprising about Contador's injury and how quickly he has come back is that it was a leg injury, and you know, Froome obviously injured his arm, and in these cases, usually, you know, a rider will get back on the turbo trainer pretty quickly, sometimes, you know, within a day or two, whereas you know, presumably Contador did have to spend a fair amount of time out of action, out of training.
There's another point, though, as well, that Contador has been racing incredibly well all year. He's been great form all year, and Froome has had a more of an up and down year, more of an erratic year. Contador, we assume from what we're seeing now, would have gone and been a real rival to Vincenzo Nibali at the Tour had he not fallen off and allegedly broken his leg. So, you know, a rider who's had that sort of high baseline of form all year, it's easier, almost regardless of the injury, to return to that. Then,
speaking from experience, Richard,
not really, no. But well, maybe a little bit. But you know, I think if your baseline of your form is high, no matter what the injury, if you can recover from it, you can get back to that to that level, I think, a bit easier than if you've been struggling to get to that level all year, as I think Froome has this year.
Yeah, and I should just say, as we record this podcast on Wednesday lunchtime, there's another mountain stage today. There's more mountain stages to come towards the back end of the week and over the weekend, and on Monday, a rest day, and then the final week's no picnic either, so anything could happen. I mean, as you say, Daniel, Quintana's over 3 minutes down, or lost 3 minutes in the time trial after his crash. And just a little note on that, I think I'm no great lover of time trial stages in Grand Tours for a number of reasons, but I think yesterday's course really kind of pushed the riders. It was a net downhill, so it was fast. It was going to be fast and hard. The start was difficult. Chris Froome kind of went out too hard and got suckered really into pushing it too hard in the early stages, and really lost his time on the downhill parts. And looking at Quintana's crash, these guys, you know, they're absolutely on the limit. And it's easy to criticise a rider falling off on his own, you know, not like a crash in the bunch. But riding these incredibly stiff bikes, disc wheels, tri-spoke wheels, deep section rims, aerodynamic handlebars, tri-bars, you know, that it's like trying to stay upright on a kind of, you know, on a I don't know what it's like trying
come
to...
Come on, Lionel, we were talking about your gift with metaphors and so on earlier
you
on.
You were, yeah, and it's and deserted
under
me.
Pressure.
You put me under pressure.
Well, Daniel and I did talk last week on the Sans Lionel podcast, in between talking about the Arctic race. We did mention that, you know, a key plank in the Team Sky preparation for any Grand Tour has been wreckying stages and being really... really knowing the course, knowing the demands of the event is what Dave Brailsford always talks about. You know, and Froome certainly, as far as we know, has not wrecked key stages such as the time trial stage. I'd imagine a lot of riders haven't wrecked stages like that, and that time trial was one that would have probably been well worth wrecking. I mean, people were talking about it being a dangerous course and so on. I saw some comment on Twitter from TJ Van Garderen, I think, saying that he was glad he wasn't riding because it looked dangerous. But the you know, Quintana's crash, it was a rider error. He blamed his brakes afterwards, but it seemed to be an error on his. He misjudged it, didn't he? I mean, it was a narrow road, but you know, you're riding a time trial. You don't need the road to be that wide, do you?
Well, no, but it was sweeping round to the right, and it did look like the road was falling off in the opposite direction. And in order to get the best line round it, you know, the road surface is perhaps a little unpredictable. But like I say, trying to maintain a steady, smooth line on these.
Anybody else fell off on it, didn't they?
No, true. But you know, when you're pushing yourself right to the limit, I mean, Richard, you know what it's like when you're just, you know, riding a bike and at whatever speed, when you just go over your comfort zone, you just feel that moment.
I don't go over my comfort zone.
You feel that moment where suddenly the bike doesn't feel like it's in control, and you know, I think, you know, Quintana, you know, it's not his absolute forte, is it, time trialing? But I do wonder this point about wrecking stages. Is it what makes the Giro and the Vuelta a little bit more open, a little bit less predictable than the Tour de France?
Anarchic. I would take issue with your comment about Quintana there. I think Quintana's a very good time trialist, especially that one yesterday. I think he would have been up there. I suspect he might have even beaten Contador in that. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, the route, it was slightly longer, but it's reminiscent, the route yesterday, of the time trial that traditionally concludes the Tour of the Basque Country, which Quintana won last year, which is, it consists mainly of it's a climb and a descent. And he was going very well yesterday before the crash, wasn't he? So, I mean, coming back to your point, Lionel, about wreckes, and we talked last week about the one reason why the Tour de France fits into such a kind of stereotype pattern is that the geography of France is so well known by virtue of, you know, everyone every year watching the Tour de France, everyone having seen, you know, 30 Tours de France, and most directeurs sportifs have either ridden or worked on, you know, multiple tours, and everyone does know the key climbs, etc., and that's simply not the case in the Vuelta.
So what are we going to see in the next... We'll be back. We'll be talking about the Vuelta again next week, but what are we going to see, do you think, over the next few days and the next week? What are... You know, Movistar in a slightly difficult position. They've got Valverde up there in second, 27 seconds back, and Quintana 3:25 back. You know, I mean, if he recovers from his crash wounds, he could still be a factor in the mountains, could he not?
Yeah, and in theory, it's a very advantageous position in the sense that, you know, Quintana now is ideally placed to have, you would think, a little bit of freedom at certain points, and Valverde will be able to sit on. I mean, I'm sure they'd rather have Quintana there leading general classification and Valverde in second or third, but at least it makes things quite clear, I think, clearer than they were from their point of view.
Yeah, I mean, Valverde does look in great form. We saw him win that first summit finish, of course. But here's a question. I'm sure he wouldn't wish a fall or an injury on anybody, but would Valverde last night have been sort of quietly, you know, sort of reflecting on the day as having been a good one for him, Lionel?
Thanks for chucking that one at me. I don't know Valverde well enough to really answer that, but in terms of team dynamics, the balance of power certainly swung back towards Valverde, didn't it? And let's not forget, we don't know the extent of Quintana's injuries yet. It may be that when he gets back on and starts pushing himself in the mountains that he feels the effects of what was a heavy fall, fast, heavy fall. In terms of when you have a Grand Tour, we've seen it in the Giro before, we've seen it in the Vuelta, where successive sort of mountain stages are very difficult. As you get into the third week, really, they unless the leader collapses and had a calamitous day caused by just completely running out of gas, sort of as we've seen from sort of Cadel Evans over the years, once or twice we've seen him spectacularly blow up. They generally tend to confirm what we already know. So at the moment, as we approach the middle point of the race, I'm anticipating just seeing Contador being strong enough to defend the lead he's got and probably stretch it out a bit. There's nothing really for him to fear if he's feeling good. The last time trial's too short to really do anything, and he would certainly be strong enough to hold anybody off. The guys who've got to attack are Quintana and Froome, and the advantage for Valverde is that he can now sit and watch and wait and ride the race that he wants to ride, which is always just being there or thereabouts. If it splits down to two or three riders, you know, often Valverde's still there, isn't he?
Rigoberto Urán, we haven't mentioned, up to third overall as well, and rode a decent time trial. He's good in these sorts of events, isn't he? I don't think any of us see him as a potential winner, but certainly a potential podium finisher. Daniel's looking very thoughtful. You've got something to say, Daniel?
I mean, you know, we talk about it almost as though it's a foregone conclusion that Contador's going to win now, but there are so many riders, as I said before, who are close to him. You know, Samuel Sanchez is only 1 minute 41 down in seventh place, and there's a real assortment of teams in there as well, with a guy with a chance on general classification, at least theoretically. That can work both ways. I mean, that can create more danger, but it also means that, you know, if one of these guys does go down the road or attack at some point, then there are a lot of teams who will be willing to collaborate to close it down. So it might actually become a bit of a stalemate at times in the last sort of 10 days.
Just lastly, sorry, Richard, before you finish off there. The thing about Contador is he's smart, isn't he? He's not the sort of rider that's going to get caught out in the wrong place on a hilly or a mountainous stage. He's got a real savvy about him, and if it was the other way round and Froome was in the lead, you might think that Froome would be vulnerable to being caught out, but I don't get the sense that Contador is going to lose the race because of a moment of being in the wrong place or just being caught out.
Before we go on to talk about the Tour of Britain, the next part, and hear from Mick Bennett, the race organiser, and Marcel Kittel, who Daniel interviewed at the Arctic race, and they had a hair off, I think, over
no,
there.
We didn't. We were going to. I was going to boycott this interview, not use any of it, because he didn't actually unveil his hairdo that day. He wore a baseball cap, which I was very disappointed about.
A very, very witty tweet about that, Daniel. He said, it's like going to see the Sistine Chapel and finding it covered up with scaffolding. Oh yeah, he says, as if he can't really remember it. That's been your tweet of the year. Don't be so. Anyway. Quick mention before we do go on to Tour Britain for Robert Hissink, who's had heart problems this year and is riding very well, ninth in the Vuelta now. Lovely story about him on Ruler this week. I don't know when it was published in Ruler, but they put it online this week, I think, by Matt Seaton, who lives in New York, Guardian journalist, and he was riding around Central Park one day, and they were joined by a guy in full Belkin kit, and initially thought, who on earth dresses in full Belkin kit? And I realised after a while it was Robert Hissink, and he was a very friendly, very charming and very strong, and he sat in the front of their group for several laps and it tapped out a nice 25 miles an hour rhythm. It was a nice story, actually. I recommend looking it up and having a read.
I actually went to Hessink's house in the Netherlands a few years ago and met him, interviewed him, and went with a photographer, and we took him out into a freezing cold afternoon and made him stand around for longer than he was comfortable with while the photographer took pictures. And it was shortly after he was very well placed in the Vuelta going into the last few days, and then he had that problem, didn't he, where he got distance. Did he crash on a descent? Crashed or got distance on a descent? But he had a string of stage races where he was in a great position until the key moment. I think he got ambushed a bit at Paris-Nice, perhaps that year, maybe the year before. But he struck me as a very sort of quiet, thoughtful guy. Really immersed himself in cycling. I remember looking at his bookcase, and it didn't have many books on it, but he did have a copy of Pro Cycling Manager, and he said he used to like playing that as his team, which was at the time Rabobank, and he'd make sure that he was a team leader and put himself in all the best races. But yeah, I wondered whether his sort of collapse in form had anything to do with the hypothermia we inflicted upon him that day.
I mean, he's the kind of rider who's perhaps a bit too thoughtful, and you know, you mentioned his problems descending there. He did a lot of work with a guy called Oscar Saiz, who's a Spanish former downhill mountain biker who's kind of
no
sorted
relation to Manolo.
No. Thibaut Pinot was trying to work with at one point, but he couldn't because Oscar Saiz was linked to Giant. But that seemed to have sorted out Hesink's descending problems to a large extent. But Dutch journalists and other riders who know him tend to say about Hesink that he's someone who perhaps dwells on things a little bit too much. You know, you said Lionel is very much immersed in his sport. And he perhaps, you know, I think we talked during the Tour de France about how one of Vincenzo Nibali's great strengths was his ability to just disconnect from cycling and racing, and that's something that Hesink has, I think, struggled to do in the past.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España with Richard Moore, Lionel Birnie and Daniel Fripp.
We're going to talk about the Tour of Britain, look ahead to the Tour of Britain now, but Daniel, do you want to introduce your interview with Marcel Kittel, who, of course, is riding the Tour of Britain, and we're going to see him compete with Mark Cavendish and perhaps sort of replay of the Tour de France, hopefully without any crashes this time. But there's a few stages where they might go head to head. But you spoke to Kittel recently at the Arctic race, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I spoke to him, I can't remember, was it Honigsvag, the start of stage two. That morning I'd seen the northernmost roundabout in the world. And then, so that
I
was.
He told us all there was to know so about the Arctic race last week. Turns out there was more.
That was, yeah, that was competing for my interest with Kittel that morning. Anyway, so had quite a long sit down and chat with Marcel Kittel in the Arctic, and I talked to him quite a lot about the price of fame, how difficult it was to keep his feet on the ground, and so here he is talking about that in Norway.
I think I'm still easygoing, and. Yeah. I know I need the balance between concentration and also relaxation, but yeah, it's just, I mean, I think I've got also bigger responsibility now, and because it also involves a lot more people now,
yep.
And it's fun to, that's the nice thing of sport, to really have a goal in front of you and to prepare for it. In the end, get the reward, or maybe even not, and then to look for things that you can change or get better.
Yeah.
I think the sport also changed my character. I learned a lot about myself. And it's always good to have people around you that sort of show you the mirror.
Yeah.
And then you learn a lot about yourself. I think that's very important.
Mm. Do you have to constantly remind yourself now not to get big-headed, or is that something that comes naturally? Because you get so much attention every time you walk into a room. That's Marcel Kittel. Do you? Is it something that you think about a lot, that you have to try and stay down to earth?
I think it's not something where I really have to remember.
No.
I think it's. I think regarding that, I'm a calm character, but it's also I think it's also important to be aware of the image that you give to people. A lot of people only see me in 1 or 2 minutes, and then the way they see you there is probably how they keep you in mind and what they think about you, and then they start to create opinions based on their experience of really a short time. And if you probably see me in a moment where I'm excited, or then they they would maybe say I'm a totally different person to how I would be, really. Yeah.
Okay. You seem everything always seems under control. Have there been periods over the last 2 or 3 years when really under the surface things maybe haven't been completely under control, and what is it that makes you kind of panic or nervous or anxious in life generally or in your in career?
Good question. I think things got never really out of control. Of course, you have moments where you think things could go better, maybe personally for me, or also somewhere else in the team or in private life. But it's always important then to look for improvements and how you can change the situation. And that's actually a little bit what I try to to do now. Then it doesn't feel like you're helpless if you try to still keep control over it.
I mean, sprinters are. you talk about private life. Sprinters are notorious for having a very kind of tempestuous private life. Yours seems to be very under control as well. Or is that just because you're quite private and we don't know? Maybe.
Maybe you don't know. I told you that I like to concentrate on goals, but I also like to relax from it. So my private life, I think, is not boring. And full stop. That's it.
So we heard there from Marcel Kittel, speaking to Daniel, and he, of course, is one of the star names at the Tour of Britain. A real coup, actually, to get him and to have him riding in the same race as Cavendish. They haven't faced each other very much at all this year. We should have seen them go head-to-head at the Tour de France, of course. That was scuppered when Cavendish took a dive in Harrogate on the first stage.
Yeah, they have not sprinted against each other head-to-head since the Champs-Élysées last year, in fact. There have been times where they've been competing in the same race and one of them has managed to contest the sprint, but the other one has been out of position and not been able to do that. And Cavendish, of course, has never beaten Kittel in a head-to-head sprint.
That's an interesting stat. I didn't realise that. Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it could happen in Liverpool, perhaps. That should be a sprint. It's a sort of shortish circuit race style opening stage to the Tour of Britain, and we expect it to be a sprint. Omega Pharma Quickstep do have a very strong team, as you were saying earlier to us, Daniel.
I've been gripped with panic now about that statistic that I've just given you. I'm going to check that, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Oh, don't worry. I'm not sure it was Lewis Mbobe who had that quote that I mentioned earlier, but it's somebody French from the 50s. Just narrows it down.
Just make stuff up, guys.
You usually do. Certainly when it comes to transfers.
Yeah, yeah. No transfer news this week. We'll sit on that. Sit on that. Just say, have you? What's that?
No, go on. We'll carry on. What were we talking about?
Kittel and Cavendish. I mean, Cavendish is working his way back. He's returned to winning form, hasn't he already? So he's probably in decent shape, but. Kittel, we probably fancy to have the edge on Cavendish. How does Cavendish beat Kittel?
Well, the tricky thing about the Tour of Britain, I know the opening stage is a sort of criterium in the centre of Liverpool. The last stage on the final day in London is another criterium. In the middle, there's probably not a lot of opportunities for bunch sprinting. Maybe Brighton, Camberley to Brighton, perhaps, and Bath to Hemel Hempstead may well, but that's a long day. It might split, you never know. But the stages to Llandudno and the other one in Wales and the ones in the southwest, I don't think that we're going to see Cavendish against Kittel. I think the problem with the Tour of Britain is that it's quite unpredictable. It's quite an anarchic race, even last year when Sky were controlling it for Bradley Wiggins. There were days when it was all just on the verge of blowing apart but would come back together. I remember the day in Wales near Dave Brailsford's hometown. Can you remember? It was all split up on the climb, Richard, and then it all just suddenly came together on the descent and the run-in, and Cavendish won the sprint there. How does Cavendish win? Well, I think he's... When you've only got six riders in a team, it makes it hard to put together a kind of a hugely conventional lead out. You're only really going to have three or four guys in the the last few kilometres. And I think it's more of a kind of shootout, really. It's a bit like a sort of five-a-side football match, these compared to a sort of 11-a-side football match. We're going to see a kind of a condensed, boiled-down, kind of bare-bones version of a bunch sprint, I think, in Liverpool.
Rugby sevens. Can we not talk about rugby instead of... Yeah. Football, please. Can before we have you got something to add to this, Daniel?
Well, I think Kittel has, we think anyway, raised the bar as far as sprinting is concerned. And I was speaking to his coach earlier this week, Adrian Hellmantle, Giant Shimano, and he was talking about how he's never encountered a sprinter who can sustain something close to their maximum power for 18 to 20 seconds. He said typically it's sort of 10 to 12, 10 to 15 perhaps at most. But and this is something other coaaches who have talked about Kittel this year have said, that he's the one sprinter who is probably still or can be still accelerating when he crosses the finish line, and that makes him fairly unique among current sprinters. And his top level power, he's putting out 2000 watts, which is probably more than even Andre Greipel at his best. So, it's a pretty complete package and pretty difficult to beat at the moment.
But, that assumes that they're always sprinting in a straight line, and it's all there's no sort of messiness or chaos to it. And I think there are probably ways, not the way that Cavendish used to win sprints, where it was a lead-out train, setting up, making it as clean as possible for him. Probably needs to make it a bit dirtier, doesn't he? Not in a dangerous way, but just... not having quite such a controlled finish. Maybe a bit of chaos and anarchy would actually suit Cavendish.
Maybe he needs to bring Nasser Bouhanni along with him just to create that chaos, because we've seen some fairly borderline illegal.
If you think about it, he's not going to win coming off Kittel's wheel, is he? Usually, he's not going to win with Kittel on his wheel, so he has to think of other ways of beating him.
I mean, this is all very hypothetical at the moment, because the bottom line is we haven't seen them sprint head-to-head, and we've certainly not seen them sprint head-to-head at their absolute best. So I think there's a bit of uncertainty on their part as well about where they stand in relation to each other at the moment. Kittel's still very, very respectful of Cavendish when he talks about him. He still says Cavendish is the best sprinter ever. Cavendish, to this point, although I think he hates the idea of losing to Kittel, he's been very respectful of Kittel. But I think... they are both a little bit uncertain about who is the fastest at the moment. Certainly, I think that the pendulum has swung as far as the press and as far as pundits are concerned towards Kittel, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Shall we hear from Mick Bennett now, Lionel? I think you spoke to him. He's the race director, obviously, of the Tour of Britain. And I think, did he tell you a little bit about the route this year?
Yeah, well, this was back in the launch for the Tour of Britain route back in January, but we thought we'd play it again because it's quite interesting to hear from Mick how they put the race route together.
The bookends of two circuit races, if you like. The start in Liverpool, the last time we were there, was 2008, and we were inundated with the many, many spectators that came out. That was quite an iconic day, I think, for Liverpool, because that's steeped in cycling history. But I think the stage that probably stands out, and you mentioned it earlier, the Robert Miller stage up the tumble, 7%, an absolute brute of a climb, and you get the crosswinds halfway up it. After that awful ramp up to begin with, I think that'll be the defining moment of the race. There's many other points, as the iconic circumnavigation of the Great Orme in Llandudno before, pre that we go through Conway and the lovely castle and that backdrop. But the whole finish right on that coastline up in North Wales will be pretty stunning as well. And there are many things, you factor in the finish onto the top of Bristol Downs there, down the Avon Valley Gorge with the wonderful Brunel Bridge in the backdrop, and that 1 kilometre brute of a climb in the side of the last 3Ks. There's so much. It's so rich this year, the ingredients. It could be won and lost anywhere, right down to the wire in Ditchling Beacon.
Indeed. Well, I remember Ditchling Beacon very well from the Tours visit in 94, and also the World Cup race, the Wincanton Classic that was in Brighton. You were saying earlier in the evening when you were unveiling the route that you have to be a little bit cute as race director, because you don't want it all done and dusted. And you were talking about the stage in Llandudno there where Great Orme could potentially end the race on stage two before it's really had a chance to get going. So as race director, you have to strike all of these different balances, not least with a look at the map here. We're a very western Tour of Britain this year, and I can already hear the people in Scotland mentioning that no Tour of Britain can be complete without a visit to Scotland. So just explain a little bit about how you strike all of those different balances.
Well, I call it on, although it was in a different era, my experience as a pro being there for 9 years, and believe me, when we do recce and I look at the climbs, I am actually visualising myself going through the pain of some of the climbs, having ridden tours in the past, and I suppose that does help. And I thought with the particular climb of the Great Orme, which you mentioned, there was the temptation to put it into the top of the Great Orme was such a temptation. And I went there twice and looked at it and photographed it and walked it and rode it and drove it, and I thought, no, it's too much. It is genuinely too much. The race would split into several pockets, which means that for the spectator and for televisually, the race effectively would be down to a hard group of probably half a dozen riders. And the ideal thing for me would be to get to the final time trial in London, although it's only 9 kilometres, and not have the race decided on GC, if you like. There might be a leader going into with a few seconds lead. So there's always that creation. It's like being a chef. It's like having all this ingredients to play with and coming up with the best cake you can bake. And I always say that I think this is the best cake this year.
Well, last year's was pretty spectacular. You had the first summit finish at Hay-Tor. This year, the summit finish at the Tumble strikes me as a much harder climb than Hay-Tor, and could well be the decisive moment of the race. But then there's still Dartmoor as well, which is not going to be easy, although it finishes in Exeter. There's a lot of climbing there. And as you said, Ditchling Beacon. You were talking a bit about how no doors are closed to the Tour of Britain now. Maybe 8-10 years ago, it would have been hard to get all of these roads closed and all of these various local authorities on side. But this year, you really are able to put together the route you really want.
Yeah, and if you like, you know, choose your ingredients again. And bear in mind that there's quite a lot of pressure on not just a venue to come up with the funding or a region to come up with the funding, but also to put the closures in that we need. And you take the stage seven, the penultimate day, one of our longest days, 224 kilometres, into Brighton. They're actually taking out the roundabout on Madeira Drive so that we can circumnavigate it safely, because you're within the last 500 metres. Those are the sort of pressures that the race puts on a host. And they are willing to do that. They often say, are our roads good enough for you to race on? And we say, you know, you should see Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders and some of the Belgian classics if you want to see bad roads. But, you know, at the end of the day, we say the roads here, listen, I live in Surrey and the roads are pretty shot after all the flooding, but they're perfectly good to race on. If a rider goes down on a bad road surface, it's deemed a sporting incident. So, you know, there is pressure on a local authority to host the event in terms of the closures, the infrastructure that we need. And because of the growth of the Tour of Britain and now live coverage, the live OB section is about half the size of a football pitch. All has to be contained within an area. So invariably, we're finishing more outside of city centres, and it's quite rare today that a city centre can actually accommodate the race in all of its glory. And it's become technically very difficult, which becomes technically challenging for the venues to put the races on as well.
Now, the race is moving up to OR category ranking with the UCI this year. That makes it one of the biggest stage races in the world. You mentioned that the transfers after stages have been reduced quite dramatically. I mean, I've been one of the critics of the long transfers in the past.
Yes,
but,
you have.
But I can also see the point. Yes, yes, I know you're saying yes, I have, yes. I did once add up that the transfers were longer than the stages on one of the years. Yes, yeah. Sorry, Mick. But
More than once.
Do you sometimes feel damned if you do, damned if you don't? Because obviously last year was quite an eastern side. You visited Norfolk and Suffolk in the last couple of years. this year is very Western, and Wales is very well represented. No Scotland, of course, and as I joked earlier, you know, people, it's a testimony to the race, I suppose, that people who aren't getting a visit this year will, there'll be howls of complaint. But you've already talked about trying to balance it up over the next 5 years. You've got a five-year contract to develop the race. So you'll be looking at other areas on a kind of rolling basis?
We are doing that. And but you know, to go back to the track, it's not as if we put them in there out of choice. And people forget that I've been a pro. I know what it's like. I don't have the big luxury coaches that never raced in those days. But I know what it's like to finish a stage knackered, to have to sit in a car and drive 4 hours to get to the finish, to get to your hotel. But we always said that our teams will be in their hotel by 7 o'clock at night, and that's we've vowed to do that. They are fantastic hotels. Yes, we've had long transfers in the past. And my reaction to the likes of yourself when it's been criticised is that we don't do it because we want to throw pain and anguish at the riders after the day. It's because it's a necessity. We've got 8 days to move this, and the funding partners that fund it want the finish there. You factor in a Friday night transfer at 5 o'clock at night in rush hour in this country on the roads that we've got. You get a snarl up on the M25 or the M4 or the A303, you're in absolute... There's nothing you can do about it.
Well, you're stuck in the traffic as well, I suppose, aren't you?
Yeah, we're monitoring with the AA and the RAC and the police the best routes. And we're advising the teams who are calling us and asking us, what are the best routes at the moment? Where are they? And sometimes we escort the teams. But I would advocate that the teams have always been sat down between 7 and 8 o'clock at night for their evening meal, regardless of how long the transfers are, Lionel. And I know that some of the stage races, they're there at midnight.
They are.
Sat down to dinner, yeah.
Yeah, I'll testify to that. Usually it's journalists waiting to interview them and delaying their dinner.
Yes.
Just lastly then, because the Hemel Hempstead stage particularly interested me, are you going around the Magic Roundabout there? They've got one of those.
No, we looked at the Magic Roundabout, yeah. We thought that was just too confusing. We actually are north of the Magic Roundabout. But we did. It was considered. It's about a mile and a half away, I think, there. And it's on the main road out, and you've got the big park on the right. I forget what the park.
Gaybridge Park, I tell you.
Gaybridge Park, that's right, yeah, on the right-hand side.
So talk me through, just briefly, how does a town like Hemel Hempstead get a finish of the Tour of Britain? Because I didn't know before I got here this evening. A very pleasant surprise for me, personally.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to it. I can stay at my own house. I live not too far away that evening. But how does a town go about getting a stage finish of the Tour of Britain, or a start?
It's ever so simple. They apply to us. And if it fits within the geography of where we're taking the race that year, it's not unusual that they won't get it. But they literally apply. And we've got applications and people we've had to turn down. If they don't get a stage finish, they'll apply for a Tour Series. And that's the joy of the Tour Series, which is the series for domestic teams in this country that has sort of compensated those venues that can't either afford or have the race that year.
Well, it's going to be a great lineup this year, I think, with the HC status. You're going to get, you know, a lot of the World Tour teams applying to be part of the race, not just being invited, but actually wanting to be part of the race. But also, you've made sure that there's still a home here for the Great Britain national team and the domestic teams as well, because I gather you think that's important to allow them to take part still.
It's always been important since 2004. I've been in the days of the Kellogg's Tour when the World Cup teams shut the race down on our roads, and it's destroyed the racing. And I think we've always kept this open view that you have continental, pro-continental and World Tour teams of an equal balance. Really does animate the event. And it's interesting that over the last several years now, the animators of the race, right from word from get-go, have been the British continental riders. And you've only got to look at how well they do. There was many of them have the leaders' jerseys going into the final day. And because it's the pinnacle of the season for them. And why not? They can shake it all up like Simon Yates did on Hay Tour. He really shook the race, grabbed it and shook it apart. And look at him now, he's got a fantastic contract with Orica Greenedge. So we will always try to strike that balance. and not have... We could have the whole event have World Tour teams in it, but we don't want it.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we heard there from Mick Bennett, and as well as the sprinters battle that we were talking about earlier, of course, there's the overall battle, and Bradley Wiggins, defending champion, really foundations for his win last year were built in that 10-mile time trial, 10-ish mile time trial. This year it's a bit shorter. It's going to be maybe slightly harder for him to get the kind of advantage from that he will need to perhaps win the race overall. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the thing with Bradley Wiggins and the Tour of Britain is it's all about motivation, isn't it? Last year it was all set up perfectly for him. The time trial in Knowsley Park was relatively early in the race. It put him into the lead, it gave him something to defend, and the team were fully committed and fully behind. In order to win the Tour of Britain this time, he's going to have to make any splits that happen in the stages in Wales, particularly on the tumble where it could split up, similarly to the way we saw it split up in Exmoor on the climb, the name of which escapes me at the moment. Richard, are you going to help me out?
No.
Hator,
where Simon Yates won the stage.
Yeah. And I think Wiggins, don't want to be too disparaging, but I think there will be plenty of opportunities for him to kind of take his foot off the gas when the race is really on. And in order to win the race overall, he would have to maintain, keep himself on the shoulder of the leader by, you know, really no more than a handful of seconds all the way through the week. And I just think we don't know yet what the weather's going to do. It could be anything. It could be wet, windy. That always makes it hard. The Tour of Britain tends to break up. You tend to get sort of 10 to 12 really strong riders come to the fore on the first tough day, and then they kind of confirm that pattern over the other tough days. And I think it's just too anarchic, really. And last year, everything fell perfectly into place for him to win. Whether they can control the race enough for all the way through it to put Bradley Wiggins in a chance to win it, I'm not sure. Don't see it. I think it will just be more aggressive. There'll be something will happen on the tumble, I think, where it will put somebody, perhaps a group of them ahead of everybody else overall, and then it will be a shootout in London in the time trial. Daniel, what are your thoughts on the Tour of Britain? Is it one of your favourite races of the year?
It's a very good race. It's always a good race. I mean, it's you know, unpredictable. So unpredictable that I'm not going to attempt to make a prediction because I don't really know who's competing. But, I mean, it's one of those, you know, these sort of lower, and without disrespecting the Tour of Britain, non-World Tour stage races without any, you know, obvious natural obstacles, pitfalls, etc., huge climbs. They tend to be quite exciting. I mean, it's like, you know, when I was in Norway for the Arctic race, you never quite know when the decisive action is going to take place, and that has been the case with the Tour of Britain often. And I think, you know, it's a mistake when organisers of this kind of race automatically assume that the spectacle will be enhanced by including bigger climbs, summit finishes, etc., because the beauty of these races is that you don't know where they're going to be decided.
Okay, I'll tell you who's going to win it.
Go on.
Jack Bauer. Garmin Sharp. Jack Bauer is going to win the Tour of Britain. I know they're coming with, you know, fully behind him. They really want him to win this race, so I think he's going to win it. no sitting on the fence at all. I mentioned for a friend of the podcast, Tao Gegenhart,
yes.
First year senior riding for Great Britain in a strong young Great British team.
10th in Tour de l'Avenir.
We're going to get him back on the podcast soon. We had a podcast with him last winter, which was excellent. He's a very interesting young man.
No gap year student's ever finished in the top 10.
No gap year student has ever finished in the top 10 of the Tour de l'Avenir.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a talent, and this is the sort of race. It's at a much higher level than he's used to. They did ride the Tour of California this year as well. But, you know, he is a great talent. He had a great result this year in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He's good in these tough, hilly races. Who knows, maybe he'll emerge as the star that we think he might become.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I enjoy about the Tour of Britain is seeing which of those young riders emerge. I mean, a couple of years ago it was Josh Edmondson who was ripping it up. We haven't really seen
Jonathan Tiernan-Locke.
Yeah, I wasn't going to necessarily mention Jonathan Tiernan-Locke. Obviously he's been stripped of his title that he won in 2012 as part of his doping ban, had his results removed. Quick mention for the tumble actually, Richard, 25 years since Robert Miller effectively clinched the Kellogg's Tour of Britain, as it was then, on the tumble. He got away in a break with Mauro Giannetti of Switzerland and Nico Verhoeven, who was a teammate of Sean Kelly's on the PDM team. And PDM had the yellow jersey that day with Martin Early, I think, and Sean Kelly was very well placed as well. And as I was making the point about the small teams, I think they only had five-man teams in that race, six-man teams this time. That doesn't make it much easier to control, but that day's racing does show what is possible in a race like the Tour of Britain when you put a tough climb in. I think on that day they went over the top and finished down in Cardiff. I can't quite remember, but the climb itself was memorable for the fact that Giannetti and Robert Miller got like 10-minute lead, and Verhoeven was in two minds as to what to do, and there was no race radios in those days. A team car was up behind him saying, well, look, can you wait for Martin Early and Sean Kelly and help chase and close down the gap? So Verhoeven got into a bit of a muddle with himself, didn't really know what to do. He stopped for a bit, and then he ended up riding the wrong way down the course to meet the bunch, turn round in the road again and help set the pace for Martin Early. It didn't work. They didn't bring the gap down enough. I think Giannetti won the stage, Miller took the yellow jersey and then clinched final victory in London the next day.
Yes, and the following year, Lionel, 1990, Robert Miller was in contention again. He was second to Michel Dernis, and they both crashed, didn't they, on the final stage in Manchester, I think it was Manchester.
As fascinating as this Tour of Britain chat is, Quintana's just crashed out of the
Breaking
Vuelta.
Breaking news.
You know? I think
he's crashed out of the Vuelta.
Yeah, he has crashed, had another crash. And that's it, gone. So
this is echoes of Chris Froome, isn't it? At the Tour.
It is echoes of Chris Froome, but does this mean we have to revisit this topic now, don't we? You know, because we did discuss it.
I think we can exclusively reveal now that Nairo Quintana's not going to win the Vuelta this year. There we are.
It does render some of our earlier discussion redundant.
Not the Tour of Britain nostalgia fest, fortunately.
He's not going to get a late entry in the Tour of Britain either. But no, I mean, it doesn't really... I mean, it affects the Movistar approach, obviously. It's certainly all for Valverde now, because that's all they've got, and he's second. So, but it doesn't change things a great deal, does it?
All eyes on Igor Anton at the Tour of Britain now, for Movistar, as far as Movistar are concerned.
A few more names I want to mention at the Tour of Britain. Nicholas Roach is riding. Mikhail Kwiatkowski, we can perhaps have more goes at pronouncing his name. He pronounced his name for us at the Tour, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he's another strong rider, you know, who could be a guy that that if he's in form, he could rip the race to pieces. Somebody like him, Nicholas Roach. There are a few others as well. Leopold Koenig, another, you know, top 10 Tour finisher, is riding for NetApp and Jura as well. Maybe on the verge of a big move to a bigger team, I understand.
He'll be fluttering his eyelids at Dave Brailsford again, won't he?
Stopping and shaking his hand, perhaps, at the team bus.
Making sure that lots of journalists are around to witness the event.
Absolutely. Brailsford scurrying away. He's riding, and again, a strong rider. So it is a good field. Every year we seem to say it's the best field ever, but it is a strong field this year. And the headline acts are obviously Wiggins and Cavendish and Kittle. So is that all we've got for the Tour of Britain, chaps? We'll be back. Daniel's off to the Vuelta next week, and you'll return with lots of special report type material, seal sanctuaries, hen parties, that kind of thing. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Lionel and I will be at the Tour of Britain, and we'll be speaking to people there, and we'll do some interviews, and we'll do two or perhaps three podcasts next week.
See how the race goes, see what the talking points are. But yeah, see you in Liverpool, Rich.
See how much there is to talk about. Yeah, I'll see you in Liverpool, Lionel.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.